It's 2 o'clock on another Sunday afternoon, and it's time for Wordplay. You're listening to WPDM 103.5 FM in Asheville. I'm your host today, Jeff Davis. With me in the studio, poet Thomas Raincrow. Say hi, Thomas.
Hi, Thomas.
Okay, all right. Thomas has a cold today, so he's not projecting as well as he usually does. And Blaze, what's Blaze's last name?
Blaze Ellery.
Blaze Ellery. Tell us a little bit about Blaze.
Well, Blaze and I have been hanging out for the last several months, just talking about poetry and sharing our own work and sharing some of the poets that we like. And Blaze has also been doing a little bit of translating. He's studying Spanish in school, and so I've been sharing with him a few of the Spanish poets that I like, and he's been coming up with some of his own and working on some translation stuff. And we've been working with his own work.
Great.
Blaze is a fine young poet, and people of Asheville need to know about him. So I thought I'd bring him along here with me today and share some of the time that we had to introduce the people of this region to Blaze Ellery and to his poetry.
Great idea. Great idea. Thomas, of course, you have a new book out. You have, in fact, since we've had you on the program, you have two new books out, or three. Yeah, this is probably the most prolific period in your publishing history.
Yeah, who's counting? But it's been a prolific year for me. It's like, you know, things come in big lumps or big clumps, and that's kind of what happened to me this last year. A lot of work kind of culminated and manifested all at once, which is not how I would have planned it, but that's just the way it worked. And had a couple books of poetry and a book of short stories come out.
Right,
so
right.
I've been busy, to say the least, with that, you know, trying to promote those and do a little bit with them. And so I'm guessing that's probably what we'll talk about today.
Yeah, well, that was sort of my idea. I thought that would be a good thing to talk about. Right, right. One of these books of poetry is Radiogenesis, which I think is really a fascinating book. These are poems from the 90s. I gather mostly early to middle 90s. Is that when they came along?
Well, it's really the culling of the best poems from the last 17 or 18 years.
Oh, really?
Which was really when my last book of poems was published of this kind of poetry, which I consider to be at the heart of my oeuvre, or whatever you want to call it. It's something that I started doing when I was in San Francisco back in the 70s, writing kind of lyrical surrealism. I was hanging out a little bit with Philip LaMantilla and Bob Kaufman, who were in the surrealist camp, and
definitely right.
Also spending a lot of time with Jack Hirschman, who's a very lyric poet in his own way. And so I guess the influences between the surrealism and the lyricism came together, and I started writing kind of a lyrics surrealism at that time. And I was also around some people like Ken Wenio and Philip Daughtry and a couple others who were writing symbolic poetry. And when we would get together, we would kind of laugh and talk about starting a new movement. We were going to call the New Symbolists. And you know, symbolism had gone out big time by then, and it still hasn't come back as far as I'm concerned. And we were hanging out in the same cafes and bars as the language poets at the time, and they were doing their thing and making a big buzz about their ideas about language and poetry. And
right.
And we had this concept about symbolism, and we were all writing symbolically in different ways. But
what does it mean to write symbolically? I mean, how is that different from metaphor, for instance? I mean, what is a symbolist poem? It's 25 words or less.
Yeah, it'll probably be much less. It's using metaphors that have at least two or maybe three or more meanings. So that it's like playing three-dimensional chess in a way. You've got a lot of moves going on, a lot of things going on the one dimension, but there's also another dimension of meaning behind the metaphors or behind the context of the poem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like Baudelaire and Hawthorne, I mean, are sort of obvious examples of people who would write symbolically, where there was a story going on, but there was also a deeper meaning or a second meaning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
In my case, the meanings tend to be maybe more, a little bit more metaphysical.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that means or what that's about, but that's sort of how it comes out a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So you were there in this hotbed of militant poetics and doing something quite different than the language poets.
Well, yeah, and it was kind of fun, and there wasn't an actual rivalry or any real scenes, you know, that would be remarkable in terms of.
You didn't have showdowns at the
No, there weren't any showdowns.
Late night cafes,
but there was a lot of this unspoken energy exchanged, you know.
Yeah,
and we were, you know, doing something different and coming from a different tradition, and we had this. A few of us had, you know, a little bit of a different take on poetry and poetics, but it never really manifested into a movement of any kind. It's just something we continue to talk about amongst ourselves, those of us who are still alive to tell about it.
Cool.
But anyway, the connection, though, is with Radio Genesis, is that this book is kind of a sequel to those poems,
mm-hmm.
in a way, and
they definitely partake of a surrealist metaphysic or, you know, a surrealist approach to writing, but they also have an emotional body, which a lot of surrealist writing doesn't. I mean, you know, it's sort of there, and you know it, you know, is somewhere back in the background, but it's really hard to tell what Philip Lamantia is, what the emotional content or the, if you can call it that, in a Lamantia poem. I mean, it's beautiful stuff, and you wonder where it came from. Sometimes I do, you know, when I'm reading it. But yours has an emotional body, which is really interesting. I mean, you're using it, as you say, in a lyrical way.
Well, yeah, I've always loved surrealism since I was real young, but I never really caught into the fundamentalists. I mean, André mm-hmm. Breton and the whole manifesto, you know, cadre and approach to surrealism where... there's nothing grounded. It's all about subconscious. It's all about something else, something other.
Mm-hmm.
I like the imagery that comes from surrealist poets and surrealist mm-hmm. painters mm-hmm. and surrealist musicians, actually, too. But I always needed, because of who I am, I suppose, the poems to be grounded in some way. And
mm-hmm.
so... my poems, I think, are more grounded than, you know, the French surrealists, so to speak, or even
sure.
the American surrealists, just because I don't enjoy that that kind of poetry. I appreciate it for the same reasons that you say, but it doesn't do anything for me. If the poem doesn't have a body or it doesn't have an emotion or mm-hmm. doesn't have something tangible that's earthly or recognizable to me, it's absent or something in some way. So,
I still think Pound was right. I mean, only emotion endures, and you know,
right. And you've got to find that hook somewhere in the
right.
poem, and it can come in a lot of different ways, as you know. But when I'm writing, you know, I write very sub. I let the subconscious and the unconscious go free. So in process, I really work a lot like the surrealists did and do, but. I'm always mindful of what I'm writing about in the poem.
Mm-hmm.
What drove me to begin the poem in the first place?
The ground of the poem.
Instead of just losing myself to everything else that is either there or not there, I always got at least one foot on the ground, you mm-hmm. know, as I'm writing.
And at the same time, you're plugged into the dictation or the, which is what the radio, the term Radio Genesis comes from. This is the metaphor of the Cocteau explorers and his Orphée.
Right.
Of the poet is radio. Yeah.
Literally, Radio Genesis explains my process, and it's a literal homage, really, to Cocteau's Orpheus film and mm-hmm. the whole scene where Orpheus is in the car in the garage, and he turns the radio on, and all this surrealist poetry is coming through the radio,
mm-hmm.
and he's taking it down as fast as he can, and that's
mm-hmm.
really how I write.
Mm-hmm.
And so that metaphor was a very strong one. For me, and always has been ever since, you know, my first experience with the film,
mm-hmm.
it stayed with me, and it seemed like a good way to explain my process, and it also explains these poems.
Mm-hmm. Great. Why don't you read a few?
Well, probably the most obvious thing I could do was to read the title poem.
Yeah, the Radiogenesis poem. That'd be great.
It's very different than all the rest of the poems in the book because it's really almost a mythic and descriptive poem. But I use it here only because it is an introduction to the process and the poems that follow. Radiogenesis. The mind is a car radio. The body is Cocteau's Orpheus. The sexual attraction is toward the car as Delphic lover. The love is for the radio, which is the spirit of the lover. The love act between radio and poet is radiogenesis. God is universal mind. Space-time is thought. The radio is the mind of the poet, the fertile egg, the poet whose dials are tuned to the right frequencies that drink in cosmic milk, white knowledge, coming from the mind of God as sperm. The union of sperm and fertile egg creates the starburst chemistry of Genesis, radiogenesis. The process of translation of these electrical impulses is genetic, electrogenetic, and the result is words. The writing of these words makes the poem. Hours, at all hours, spent in the garage, in the passenger's seat of the car with the radio on, searching the dial for a voice on the other side of static, for an inspired, paradoxical juxtaposition of spoken sounds, for a metaphor for daily life as light, radiogenesis, or in attic rooms or dapple-ganged hotels listening to the silence between screams for a sign of sanity, radiogenesis. This is the work. This is the stuff of a stuff better than sex. The horror of Orpheus, the nightmare of Eurydice, the thing invisible that becomes seen, the king of the forgotten, the siren queen.
Neat.
So in a metaphorical and symbolical way, that sort of describes my writing process and, and what I mean by radiogenesis.
Well, let's delve into some of the poems. Are they arranged in the book somewhat chronologically or
no,
thematically?
Well, it's in two sections.
Right.
One section entitled Night Vision are the more narrative poems, more narrative and message-oriented, I think. Some of them even have little stories. They all are driven by rhythm and lyric, but and the metaphors are tend to be surreal, but they're not quite as free-floating as the poems in the second part. The section is entitled The Calligraphy of Fire, and these are truly lyrical. At the time of writing them were really lyrical experiments. I was writing in a vein that I just wanted the lyric to drive the poem, and I was writing really with the idea in mind that these are not poems that would probably ever be published. I'm just writing for my own enjoyment. And I wasn't controlling or censoring them nearly as much as I would normally. And years later, I went back to them and I found that, you know, some of these experiments were worth keeping. And some of them needed a little bit of polishing up, but they're true lyric. I mean, I literally let the rhythm and the lyric and the word choices drive the poem. And they tend to be a little bit more off the ground and ungrounded maybe than the poems in the first part.
Okay. Well, let's hear some poems from the first part and the second part.
All right. Let me give you one here. This is a good, example of a rhythm-driven poem. When I was writing it, I was really writing it as a song almost, in the sense of it has a very definite form. It has a song style that I've created for myself just to accommodate, you know, the words and the language that I'm using. But it's definitely a form poem. It's organized in a rhythm driven kind of way. I think you'll be able to pick it up if I can project enough.
Okay, all right. You're doing pretty good so far.
It's called "Say the Unspoken Word," and it begins with an epigram by Adonis or Adonis, a Persian poet, a Palestinian poet. I want to pray to gods that have never heard of prayers. Say the unspoken word and make me a memory. Take my name down from the marquee. Tell our mothers we're rich and have gone off somewhere to fight, have gone to town to sell our wings. Tired of the way love rubs wrong the music and leaves dust, rust of what was polished bronze before it was buried in peat. Sing the lost chord or the last refrain of silence and move me to tears. Move me away from the burning fire. Tell those that have read my poems that they were all written with stolen flames, sunspots lifted from the mouths of saints, baby's breath taken from the lips of burned books, crooks climbing the windows for the thief of light. Think the last thought and remind me of music. Tell the songbirds fond of screens we have run out of dimes, riddled the life out of wombs, immaculate or chaste, in the convent of a smile, where I have been locked up in rooms of wind that blow like words do in and after angry books of love unwritten before I walked away.
Neat. I like the motion of that.
So, yeah, the motion is really carried in the beginning lines of each stanza. And it's kind of a... I've used the same device in every stanza to begin it. Say the unspoken word and make me a memory. Sing the lost chord and move me to tears. Think the last thought and remind me of music. So, you know, it's really written like a song.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so. Every stanza has the same number of lines, too. So there's, you know, a structure there that hopefully holds up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice. Let's read some more from that section.
Well, how about a love poem?
How about a love poem? Yeah, a lot of these are love poems.
A lot of them turn out to be love poems. It's funny how you can do something and spend a lot of time on it. It comes out in a book form, and Jack Hirschman, who wrote the introduction for this book, writes, you know, and makes mention of the fact that there is a lot of love emotion and sentiment going on, and that was something I didn't realize until after the fact.
Yeah, well, you're a natural love poet, so yeah.
This is one. The book is dedicated. It's dedicated to some friends of mine that died in 2006. I had a hard year with close friends in 2006. My good friend Ken Wainio and Michael Davitt in Ireland and Sam Gray here from the mountains. All died within a year of each other in that year time frame. And this is a poem that's dedicated to Nan, who is my partner in life. And it's called Iris. Lips like the fever of forget-me-nots wanting to be iris and not wanting to die at the end of spring, cover my sleep. Cover me quilt warm even as the loss of you lingers like shy tears behind this mask of being in love and the lover who is listening for the sound of his own kiss. Why must we wait for the rain when we are already wet? Already like lake water caressing the earthy sex of the shore. Somewhere beneath the windrow of numbers we have mowed and raked into time, the dew is turning to heat, into the flowers' wings that want us to fly. Here, take the Duende and Lorca's Night, like the bouquet I have made for you, wrapped up in poems. This is why we are here, is why I have built my own bed. A vase for the sacred purple parts of you I want to watch as you rest. My eyes making love to every stem, leaf, and stamen in your dreams.
Nice. We've had Nan on the show, of course, a couple of times, and she's going to be on again once. Now that we're in our format, we already have some recording of her work with Yvonne Goll. Yeah, so I know she's also your co-translator on Yvonne Goll's 10,000 Dawns.
Right. Well, we've had a lot of fun with the Golls, and she's taken on a whole new project on her own, and this book of hers, Traumkraut, or Dreamweed, as she calls it, is really a masterpiece. And
It is a remarkable work.
Yeah. And it's fun. It's fun hearing her on the radio doing her own thing.
A remarkable partnership. Well, you know, one of the poems that I really enjoy in that section is Breastfeeding.
Oh, you bad boy, you.
My mischievous side comes out.
Well,
that and Mood Swings, I've got to say, I really like both of those a lot. Yeah.
Well, yeah. We're talking about love poems, and I guess it doesn't get any more graphic than this.
Well,
in a way.
It's intimate. Yeah.
This is a true story, by the way. I mean, I'm bad for writing about what I know. And this little episode actually occurred in New York many years ago. But this is the poem called Breastfeeding. It may well have been Greece there that night in New York, with the rain dripping onto her window ledge and twilight covering the city like a golden shroud. It was too late for dinner, even though the table was set and the baby asleep in its bed. The rain and the infant hunger growing in my stomach reminded me of childhood in the southern mountains, and how each summer afternoon it stormed, and how calm it was after the thunder and lightning had moved on. After we made love, and after a long while, she said, "I ache." The warm milk from her large breasts tasted like Greek honey, lying there by the window, looking up at the golden rain.
Nice. Now, that's a more discursive poem than a lot of the others in the book.
It is, but I couldn't resist throwing it in. because I like it as a poem. I mean,
it's nice.
This book is mostly lyrical and mostly surreal. It's not perfect in that sense. There are some other kinds of things that are thrown in.
Heaven forbid.
Yeah. the perfect wave or the perfect book, I guess, is probably yet to be presented.
Yeah, but, haven't seen it.
But so there are a few poems like that one that appear and occur that are a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Whereas the Mood Swings is much more in the surrealist and dictation mode. I think.
Yeah. Let's see. Let me see if I can find it here.
Which is only...
here it is.
Yeah, a couple pages on. Right.
Okay. A request. Mood Swings. Press your lips to my face. Take something fleshless from my cheeks. Call it the absence of things, or the dreamed of absence of fire. Let the future of autumn know that this act of love is really only the death of June. That the thought of soft, cool wind is the blood that keeps us alive. When you go down on your knees, even the Andes shake like a dove shuddering its wings. And why do you refer to this as prayer? Come, raise yourself up from that beggar's pose. We've come too far for old habits and dreams of dirt. Let's talk about tigers and the transfigurative aerodynamics of wings. These things that, like uncommon magic, makes lava out of lightning, lying dormant in our words, and sings.
Yeah, that's nice. That reminds me of like a really good Lamantia poem.
Well, you know, there may be some direct steals there, direct unconscious steals, to say. I mean, after all, there's, you know, my take is that we're all thieves of words and in our own little ways. You know, some of us are better at it than others, and we all do it in our own unique ways. And there's a lot of Philip LaMantia that rubbed off on me, just like there's a lot of Bob Kaufman and Ferlinghetti and Hirschman and a million other poets.
Yeah. What does they say? Bad poets borrow and good poets, great poets steal. So.
Right. I'm not ashamed to admit it. And, but Dylan Thomas also had played a pretty heavy hand, really, and always has, really, in my poetry. And so there's the lyric surreal quality of his work, I think, is also a major influence.
Dylan Thomas sort of brings surrealism into English in a way.
Right. I think you're exactly right. Yeah. Like nobody else has, especially from that part of the world.
A Welshman of all. I mean,
right,
hey.
Right, exactly. You know, so, and you know, in the first part, there's a quote that I, you know, use from a Dylan Thomas poem, and then the second part, you know, the calligraphy of fire, it starts with an epigram by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who. Is another kind of he's definitely a lyric poet, and he's maybe not a surrealist so much as being the father of the cascading lyrical image, I've loved Hopkins' work for that reason. He's very fluid and free, and it's reading a Hopkins poem is literally like taking a bath in a waterfall. It's just water rolling over rocks into pools, into pools, you know. And
another master of rhythm the music of the poem.
And I think that he had a big influence on this experimental phase where I was writing these, you know, super lyrical poems.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe let me just read an example of one of those.
Oh, that's a great idea.
This one's called Learning Latin. From the point of no return, I reach for the moon in the movement of morning, after the radiogenesis of sleep, sleepwalking the somnambulous floor for hours, and all night when nothing but the starry-eyed hoot of the owl outside sings, "Won't quit you, babe," to the Beelzebub night in the street, so bright not even the blind can sleep, can snore loud enough for summer to know it's spring somewhere, when not even a crocus could care, could call a spade, enamored of lies. Here the hick, hike, hoke, Julius, Julius, Julius of the verb to be, can't even comb its own hair, can't castrate a noun for the rape of hunger, or the forethought of $100, barking up the tree of greed, going out of sight into the ozone of oil and the mother of all wars, whenever there is nothing to do but be homeless under the exegesis of stars and be free.
Nice. You're listening to Wordplay on 103.5 WPVM, the Progressive Voice of the Mountains in Asheville, North Carolina. Thank you. that's Jeffrey Keyser's Horsewoman from his CD Falling Up, which also, of course, furnishes our theme song. So, Thomas, we're back here live with Thomas Raincrow and Blaze Ellery. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and you're listening to Wordplay. So, Thomas, let's hear some more Radio Genesis. This is really a watershed book, I think, for you in some ways.
Well, it is. I'm actually very happy with this book. Like I said, it's not a perfect book, but sometimes you go back and you look at things that you've done in the past and you're not quite satisfied with them, or you wish you'd done them a little differently. And so far, I'm pretty happy with the way this book feels, and I don't feel like I have to apologize for it. It feels pretty good to me, and I'm kind of proud of it in a kind of a non-egotistical kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
It really represents, you know, really what I think comes from the heart of me as a poet, and the process that I use that is most like me. I mean, mm-hmm. I've done some mm-hmm. other kinds of books that are different form, different styles, and they're okay,
mm-hmm.
but this is really at the heart of what I do, and that I enjoy this kind of writing the most, I think.
Right. Yeah.
And so we're into this Radio Genesis mode in the lyrical surrealism, and this poem is called Immortality. I like this poem because of its visual images as much as anything. I'll just read it. When I write on your white skin with dark ink, and the calligraphy of unspoken vowels covers arms and legs, page-like, covers back, belly, and thighs, and the thought that is born from words makes midnight blink and the morning go blind. I find the wherewithal to make my mistakes indelible and stained in truth so that they will last even after your body has gone to the morgue and only ashes remain on stretched canvas as a work of art.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. in that sense, I'm really trying to define immortality, at least the immortality of a poet from a poet's perspective, but I'm doing it through the process of a painterly metaphor, mm-hmm. and I'm mm-hmm. using the skin of the woman as the canvas for, mm-hmm. for this, and mm-hmm. trying to create a feeling for what it feels like, the important aspect of being a poet and his or her connection with the need for some kind of immortality
mm-hmm.
Through their work. And I think all great poets have that in their genome, so mm-hmm. to speak. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just kind of there, and it's kind of coupled with ego. You know, I think poets, for the most part, have enlarged egos, among other things.
A few, yes, yeah. Right, yes.
And but that's all part of the driving force to mm-hmm. to get the work out and to have it become effective in whatever way that it might. And
yeah, the hard thing about dealing with ego is that you have to get it out of your way,
right?
You know, otherwise it becomes a real stumbling block too. Yeah,
right. But
right. So we've all seen that.
I don't think I've ever talked to a poet, especially an aging poet, who doesn't speak at least indirectly about his own or her own immortality.
Oh yeah,
whereas
sure.
their work mm-hmm. is concerned, we all want our work to survive us. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Sure, right, right. I mean, otherwise, why bother? I guess. Except that one simply has to. So, yeah. You know, as Snyder says, what, you know, the world expects of us is song. So,
it's part of the package, you know. You know,
part of the deal.
Some of us are more private than others, but those of us who have chosen to go public, you know, that's the immortality, mm-hmm. you know, genome or gene is there, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, great. And you also have other books out now, and we ought to at least mention them. And I think one of the one I really enjoyed is House of Girls. And you know, if you wanted to read from that, we could, or we could save that for another time. But it's got some really fun stories. These are autobiographical fictions,
right? It's essentially a collection of stories that I wrote over probably a period of 15 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all autobiographical. They're all true stories. And they're all about different relationships I had with...
Is that true in quotation marks?
No,
actual
it's
literal.
Yeah, it's literal.
Yeah, okay.
And these stories are true to the bone. I mean, there's, mm-hmm. there's not much
so
exaggerating.
Right.
And manipulating to create storylines. And this, these things actually all happened in the way that I remembered them. Some of the language gets a little flowery and interesting, but that it doesn't change the storyline. But so it's a collection of stories about women that I've known that have had an important impact on my own life and in various ways. And over the years, I had the courage, I guess, to write them down. And I think, you know, reading Aeneas Nin and Henry Miller didn't hurt me any in terms of an impulse to write these and to write prose. At the time, I really hadn't written prose in this form at all, so I was a little bit leery of trying it and a little bit squeamish, but it turned out okay. And hopefully these stories are a good read.
They are. Yeah,
that's the object. I don't think it's great literature, but hopefully they'll resonate with people. And I've had a lot of conversations since this book has come out with others who talk about if they're women, they might start the conversation by saying something like, "Well, my house of boys, I can remember a time when, you know, and the story will go on." And so it's kind of created a keystone for people talking about relationships and talking about love. And that's really the bottom line is, I'm kind of a love junkie, and any excuse that I can find to write about love is as good as
a good one. Yeah, right.
And this just happens to come in the form of prose stories.
Yeah, and they're very entertaining.
And some of them are more literary than others, and they take place. It's a global book in a sense. There's the first book starts off in France and it migrates to Northern California and San Francisco and moves to New York and takes place in the mountains of North Carolina, and there's a story in Pennsylvania. So it is international in that sense.
Yeah,
it's kind of a coming-of-age book. Most of the stories were from the period when in my 20s and 30s.
But so a couple is this your Sturm und Drang book?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, in the tradition of all those coming of age writers, you know, Goethe and Joyce and Dickens and some of those guys, you know. Yeah.
You're Wilhelm Meister.
Right. Yeah.
Well, good. It's really a good read. I urge people to go grab it. It's on sale now, I guess, available out in the world. I know Malaprops here in Nashville has it. So,
should be. And if your bookstore doesn't have it, it's easy to order. Just ask for it. It's called A House of Girls.
House of Girls. Thomas Raincrow. And who's that from? What press?
It's Wind Publications. It's a publisher up in Kentucky, just south of Lexington. Their niche is publishing writers from the Southern Appalachians, mostly, that either write about the region or that are from the region in one way or another.
Yeah.
So,
good read.
We're having a good time with it. I have to say it's the most fun I've ever had on the road with any book. Even Zorro's Field, which was has been a great book for me. This book of stories is just nothing but fun, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Of course, we haven't heard from the girls yet. I don't know how they're thinking about it, but it has actually reconnected me with a couple of these women, and it's been fun getting to know them again.
None has filed suit yet, or anything.
Not yet. There's a disclaimer in the credits page, so you know we're covered.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. The disclaimer is what the usual standard. Events in this book bear absolutely no relationship to the world as it happened, as it transpired. Yeah.
So the book is being marketed as autobiographical fiction, when in truth it's
more memoir.
It's more of a memoir.
Yeah, I think of it. It's a really neat companion piece in some ways to Zorro's Field, because it gives the other side of the life. You know, I mean,
it's kind of what happened before Zorro's Field.
Yeah, it's sort of around Zorro's Field.
What drove me to the woods.
To Zorro's Field.
Love will do it every time. You know, 4 years alone in the woods, you know.
But, Yeah.
Let's not digress. Let's talk to Blaze a little bit.
Let's hear some of what Blaze is doing.
I'm very excited about Blaze Ellery. He was introduced to me about a year or so ago, and we've gotten to know each other very well, and we've been hanging out now for a while, and we just get together periodically and talk about poetry and talk about each other's work, and he shares with me, and I share with him, and it's fun because, you know, we're talking across generations. His generation is the up and coming young.
How old are you now, Blaze?
I'm 17.
17. All right. Prime time. Yeah.
So, you know, here's this kid that's writing these fabulous poems and really has his head to the ground, and he's a world traveler. He lived in Africa for a time, and he's writing some great poems about Africa and his memories of Africa, and he's amazingly enough writing some great love poems.
Great. Well, you know, at 17, that's
got my attention. So you know, I really wanted to bring him along with me and to introduce people to him and to his work, and I'm gonna let you guys have at it.
Blaze, read us a poem. Jump right in.
Sure. Thanks again, Thomas, for the great introduction. Okay, the first poem I'm going to read is The Accident. You know, a lot of these poems, you know, are based off of my my time in Africa, you know, and all the emotions and images related to that. Mm-hmm. So the first poem is The Accident. The Accident. It is like some grotesque dance. The beauty in the anatomy, not the motion of it. Your discarded breath hit the asphalt, hot and heavy like your rusty blood that now bakes in the noonday sun. Across the street, the butcher is at work in his stall, in his brutal shop of amputations. Glimmering black flies are dancing, the only procession. Red tributaries fill the gutters, and children play in the refuse. As the stretchers go by, I see the dance continue. Your arms and legs, hemmed in under the still frame of a car, your dark face and bright eyes, now dark, covered by a stained white cloth.
Hmm. Some nice images there. Yeah.
When I lived in Africa, you know, they were pretty much, you know, maniacs on the road. You know, they drive on the sidewalk, drive pretty much anywhere, you know.
Sounds like Buffalo.
Yeah.
Or Boston.
rules need not apply there, you know. And so, you know, I saw a lot of carnage, a lot of accidents, you know. And so, you know, this is just kind of like an ode to that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. An account. Right. Well, let's hear some more.
Yeah, okay. The next poem is Pregnant in Africa. And, you know, it's... I used to live next to this river, and, you know, the women every day would get up and wash their clothes with their children by their side, and, you know, just wash in this water and, you know, sing songs and, you know, just, you know, be a community. And this is, you know, another ode to that. Pregnant in Africa. This land is still pregnant, not yet given birth to a screaming infant whose rough-cut eyes will gleam in the fits of the sun overhead. Out behind the hedge grove, the women, too, are pregnant, their swollen bellies parting the river's waters as they settle themselves down on stone basins, their fists full of white cloth that sinks and rises as they wash it against the stones, white clouds harbored in the banks of the river. They figure that you take your life into your own hands, hold your serpent in one palm, and life... in the other.
Yeah, nice. What period in your life were you in Africa? What was your age?
Age, I was. Yeah, let me see, I was, you know, around 10 or 11.
Yeah. So you're pretty fully young. Conscious of the world.
Then. Oh yeah. I mean, in my opinion, Africa is what really made me conscious of everything. You know, before that, you know, I say that I was just a normal, you know, American kid, didn't know anything of any other else, no other people, you know, just knew. My perfect little life, you know, nothing outside the box. And when I went there and saw how these people lived and saw just, you know, some of these horrible things, it just, you know.
Certainly takes really you outside the box, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Live in a different culture. Right. Yeah, I guess we've all had that at some point. For me, it was living in the Northwest with the Kwalawak people. And for you, France, perhaps, that was a dislocation.
definitely.
Yeah, definitely an important dislocation. Yeah.
Yeah, I really think, you know, travel, you know, it's, you know, one of the best things, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Better than school, from my opinion, you know. Mm-hmm. You can travel
learn,
out.
Learn
you know?
More, right. Yeah, yeah. Very quickly, too. I mean, there's something about the immersion of travel.
It's different.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's hear some more. Let me say first that we're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5. I'm Jeff Davis, and with me today, Thomas Raincrow and Blaze Ellery. And we're now talking to Blaze. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Sure, yeah. Well, let's hear another poem, Blaze.
Sure, okay.
Is this another African piece?
Another. One more African piece.
Okay, all right.
It's called Two Mornings. The mosques call every morning and wake the chickens next door. A good night's rest is lost, eaten up by the beginning of the day. The light outside is no different from the black I see underneath my eyelids. It is the same delirious night that I hear every morning. The rhythm of the mosque, the banging of the avocado fruit on tin roofs, and the slight murmur of mosquito wings. This is the substitute for the arcing backs and howls of coyotes back home. It's really just, you know, the thought of, you know, going from one place I used to live in Mexico to going to this place and, you know, relating the two, the change in my life.
Mm-hmm. You know? Sure. Yeah. I was thinking the coyotes weren't from around here, but.
Yeah, not from the mountains. No.
Yeah. I mean, we have a few,
well,
actually.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Actually, yeah. More than a few.
Yeah. They're moving in.
They're moving.
Right. Yeah. But, yeah, having spent some time in New Mexico myself, I recognize the, the Western ambiance. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, neat. So what are you doing now? Are you in high school or are you finishing up?
I'm in high school. I'm a junior in high school. Mm-hmm. You know, I go to Charles D. Owen High School in Black Mountain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so you're here then. Yeah.
Right near, just a couple. Yeah. 10 minutes away.
Right. So, yeah. Where are you living? Do you live in Asheville proper? Or you probably live out in Black Mountain, Swannanoa?
You know, little small town of Black Mountain.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Great little small town.
Yeah. It's great.
Oh, great. Yeah. Well, let's hear another poem.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess I'm going to change a little different and live, you know, a little, I guess you'd say a little love poems, you know?
All right. Yeah. Let's hear some love poems.
Okay. First one. The heart is a woodshed. The moment is brief. The good sap collects in the woodshed of the heart, drawing the company of the honeybees. What sweet warmth is made from the buzz of their wings here inside my heart. This night, in my hunger, I go down to the woodshed. The trees' thighs are torn, their broadening rings ready to still the murmur, muffled by golden wax.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the poets whose work has meant a lot to you?
Well, you know, I gotta thank Thomas for a lot of things. You know, before that, you know, I didn't really. Before I met him, you know, I was more academic poets, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But now I know he's you know, introduced me to Rumi and the mystics, and you know, most, you know, what I really love right now are, you know, the Spanish poets, you know, Neruda and Jimenez and Lorca, and they've been profoundly influential, you know, before. You know.
Oh yeah, they're amazing poets.
I hate with them a lot.
Yeah, amazing poets.
I hate them a lot, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
any other poets writing in English that you can think of?
Yeah, English. Yeah. Let's see. I like the beats, you know, like Gary Snyder, and I've been interested in that a little bit. And, you know, the traditional poets, you know, like I like Yeats. I've been looking, really enjoyed Yeats and just kind of his take on life and everything.
Oh, yeah. What about, have you read Pound yet, or?
Ezra, yeah.
Ezra, a good old Ezra.
I enjoy all of them,
Yeah. Pretty amazing poet.
Yeah.
In his time, indeed. What about Eliot and those guys? Have you run into Eliot and?
Yeah.
Cool. Right. It's, you know, I forget what it's like sometimes when you're just coming into poetry. It's really a hoot. It's a big, big world.
It's crazy sometimes, just the amount of poetry. You know, like every corner, there's a new poet. There's a new, you know, since writing, everything's new and, you know, full of life. So it's just, you know.
And eventually you find your way through it. I mean, you know, and find the ones that really mean something to you and steal from them.
Yeah, you know. to learn from.
Yeah, how do you work? Do you work at a computer? Do you work in longhand? Do you scribble on napkins?
It changes, you know. It kind of depends, you know, where I am. You know, sometimes, you know, the poems just kind of hit, and, you know, I kind of write on whatever I have, you know, be it, you know, a postcard or a scrap of paper, or sometimes sit down just at the computer and write, or sometimes I just, you know, sit on my front porch in the summer and just, you know, just write, just sit out and write and think of, you know, all the good times I've had.
Yeah, cool. Excellent. Yeah. Well, let's hear another one.
Okay. Well. Hunger. I am stowing the every movement of your body within me, and sowing each one in the vast fields of my open heart. I am taking even the drunken spectacles of your eyes and your sweet honey mouth to remind me of the love that we have shared in this black canvas of night. Oh, dark assailant of my heart, one day in my starvation I will harvest the moments that I've taken from you and will feast, remembering the virgin heat of the pale moon, stroking the vulture spirals of your hair.
That's nice. Nice imagery.
How about a 17-year-old being able to write that way?
Yeah. Let's hear that one again. Read that one again.
Sure.
Yeah.
Hunger. I am stowing the every movement of your body within me, and sowing each one in the vast fields of my open heart. I am taking even the drunken spectacles of your eyes and your sweet honey mouth to remind me of the love that we have shared in this black canvas of night. Oh, dark assailant of my heart, one day in my starvation, I will harvest the moments that I've taken from you and will feast, remembering the virgin heat of the pale moon, stroking the vulture spirals of your hair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice.
Nice. Well, I would have given anything to have been able to write like that when I was 17.
Right. Yes. Yes. I can't remember what I was writing like at 17, but it wasn't
We probably don't want to.
No, right. Right. Don't want to go there.
Yeah. But Blaise is great. He's studying Spanish, and so while he's writing, while he's reading, you know, the Spanish poets, he's also, you know, beginning to get interested in translation. So I think this is exciting for me.
It's always good.
For me to watch his interest in getting into translation as his language skills improve and his knowledge of the Spanish poets grows. You know, and it's exciting to watch, and I'm real anxious to see some of the results of his first translation efforts. So
yeah. Do you know the work of Robert Bly yet? Have you encountered Bly's?
Yeah.
Especially actually, his translations from the Spanish, of course.
Yeah, spend, I don't know, it was a couple months ago, I got to meet up with him and with a couple other people and, you know, for the workshop, and he's an amazing individual. Just all his different writings, it's amazing.
Yeah, he's pretty, you know, and he's going to be here in Nashville you know, March 28th, I believe it is, and 29th. He'll be doing a reading at the Diana Wortham Theater with some musicians, including some of the Boat Rockers.
Yeah, Robert stole my band.
Smart man.
Well, you know, Coleman did the same thing.
Yeah.
So there's something about these guys that are translating the Sufis. They don't have any compunction about stealing it all. But no, actually, it's Chris Rosser's in his band is going to be playing with Robert Bly on the 28th, so it's a totally different dynamic.
Yeah. And that's going to be a really interesting show. I'm really looking forward to
that
it because
be very exciting.
Bly is going to be really reading his love poems. And, of course, we're talking about, you know, human and divine love. So,
right.
Because he's one of the great translators of the mystics. It should be fascinating.
It should be an elevating evening. I can't see anything that could stop it from becoming, you know, a memorable evening.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, for sure. You going to be there, Blaise? You're going to try and catch Bly again?
I think I am. I'm going to try. I'm trying to.
Should be an excellent show. Well, let's listen to a little bit of, speaking of the Boat Rockers.
Yeah.
Let's put on a little bit of the Boat Rockers.
Should we go out with the Boat Rockers?
Why not? And I got to say, this is 103.5 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. You've been listening to Wordplay. My guests today have been Thomas Raincrow and Blaise Ellery. And this is Thomas Raincrow and the Boat Rockers doing The Essence of Grace.
Poems of Hafiz.
Poems of Hafiz.
Now that I have raised the glass of pure wine to my lips, the nightingale starts to sing.
Hoard life subtlety.